Welcome to yet another episode of Shortcast Over Coffee. Today's guest is David Roberts, more popularly known as Dr. Volts on X. David is an influential writer and communicator on clean energy and climate change public policy. He hosts the top podcast in the space called Volts. David Roberts has spent over 15 years covering energy and climate change, most prominently at Vox. His insightful analysis and commentary have made him one of the leading voices on the urgency of decarbonizing our economy. David has a knack for breaking down complex policy problems and clearly explaining clean energy solutions to a mass audience. I highly recommend checking out David's podcast, Volts. In this episode, we are talking about climate change, public policy, and clean energy. Please do like, share, and subscribe this channel, Shortcast Over Coffee, on top podcast platforms like Spotify, Apple, etc. Now, without further ado, let's dive right in. Hello, David. Welcome to the podcast.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Awesome. I have been resisting asking this question to every guest of mine. I feel like I'm getting a lot repetitive with this question. But I cannot resist in your case, because I was going through your LinkedIn and your background, and I see that you started off in a completely different domain. You did a master's in philosophy. I think you did a minor in snowboarding, if that's right.
That was half a joke.
Okay. What was it? Okay. So you did come from a completely different background, but at the same time, you have been writing about climate change since, I don't know, 2005, 2006. It's been close to 20 years now. When did this shift happen? I was like, I'm not going to ask this question to my next guest about his or her background, but I can't resist in this case. So how did you move?
It's pretty random. As you say, I was in grad school getting degrees in philosophy, intending to go into academia. But then I got to ABD, all but dissertation, as they say, and got a little closer look at academia and said, no thanks, and dropped out. And then after that, I was adrift, no job skills, really, no job history. So it was completely random that I just found a ad on Craigslist for an assistant at a small web publication, and that was Grist, which I went on to work for 10 years. At the time, I think I was the fifth employee. They're up to, 50 or 60 now, I think. But at the time, it was a very small shop. So, and back then, it was just environment stuff. And so I didn't have any history in journalism or experience in journalism. I didn't have any history in environmentalism, or even, if I'm being totally honest, any particular interest in environmentalism. but I was desperate to just find a job that wasn't some boring entry-level tech job, which was all that existed in Seattle at the time. So anyway, long story short, I went to Grist and started out just as sort of like an assistant doing research and writing blurbs and news summaries and things like that, and just slowly over time wormed my way over into full-time writing. Which is just to say, everything I know about journalism and everything I know about the environment or climate change is entirely self-taught. I mean, I was basically raised by wolves. There weren't enough people at Grist so that I had a mentor or lots of guidance or anything. So I just completely on my own. So yeah, it's completely self-taught for all, there are good aspects of that and bad aspects of that, but that's my situation. And so, it started out general environment stuff. And then I sort of started looking closer at climate change, and it really appealed to me. I think, it's become clearer in retrospect that my training in philosophy actually was, it turns out, pretty useful. Like, and this is what attracted me about climate change, is for the same reason I was attracted to philosophy. I like big systems. I like big questions. I like thinking about big systems and how the parts fit together. Like climate change, lots of environmental problems are, they're difficult politically, but they're not complicated, right? They're not difficult to know what's going on. Like if you put a dirty thing in the water and it pollutes the water and that's bad, you know, it's pretty intellectually pretty simple. But climate change, especially at the time, this back in like 2004, 2005, it was new enough that, and big enough that people really didn't even know really how to think about it, right? Like, what kind of thing is it? What is it exactly? You know, you could look at it as a political problem or problem of human nature. You could look at it as a technical problem. You know, it's all those things at once. So just the sort of complexity of it and the multi-layered nature of it really appealed to me. And then through that, over time, I started, you know, I realized that like writing about climate change as such was not super interesting, mainly because it just not a lot of, it doesn't develop a lot day to day, right? It's just like a tiny increment warmer today than it was yesterday. And, you know, there's lots of science stories, but science was not really my thing. I like politics. I've always been attracted in politics, politics and philosophy, human nature, all those kind of things. So this is a very long-winded way of saying where I ended up is solving climate change, right? Which is basically mostly about how do you do stuff that we do with fossil fuels without fossil fuels, right? And that is an enormous puzzle with an enormous number of pieces, all of which are sort of sub-puzzles, all of which are fascinating on their own. But like how they all fit together and how do you coordinate them? It's just such a fascinating technological question. It's a fascinating political question. It's fascinating just in terms of like how humans think and, you know, all sorts of things. It just implicates everything. So, you know, I think my training in philosophy in sort of like constructing and deconstructing arguments and thinking about how things fit together has really been helpful. So that's where I am now, basically, is like the puzzle of solving climate change to me is the most intriguing and just intellectually stimulating puzzle of our time. It is the problem of our time. And I love, you know, over time, as I've written about it, going on 20 years now, as you say, it's just one of the coolest things that I've seen is young people have been gripped by it fully now, and they're flooding into it. So every one of these little sub puzzles that I look into, I just find is swarming with like super interesting, you know, hardworking, big-hearted, interesting people. So there's just like people working on this thing all over the place, and nothing counters your sense of doom and depression around climate change more than exposure to all the people who are working on it. That's why I've ended up where I am.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a super interesting answer because, you know, I remember I grew up in India, by the way, and I think from my fourth grade to my 12th grade, every single year there was this question about what are non-renewable sources of energy, what are renewable sources of energy, differentiate them. And then we kept answering the same answer from fourth grade to 12th grade. And sometimes you keep wondering, yeah, these are the differences. These are the advantages. Now what? Like, so what? You know, get something done. And I feel like, you know, when you got started, 2004, 2005 was probably a time when people were more like ranting about it or, you know, like raising the flag, alarm about it. But I feel like in the last 10 years, I think mainstream media is, you know, making it a point to tell people that, hey, this summer was the hottest summer. And I want to point out to an interesting article by Andrea Thompson on Scientific American. And the heading of the article is super interesting. I mean, it goes like, this hot summer is one of the coolest of the rest of your lives.
Yes, I've used that line many times. It's the hottest. It's the hottest it's ever been. And it's the coolest it's ever going to be.
Yeah, I mean, it's a thing to ponder about. And, you know, you look at all the charts, you look at all the graphs that mainstream media is putting out these days, it's getting worse. And it's sort of getting to a point where it's irreversible, where we are at a time when, you know, there are so many people flooding in, like you mentioned, you know, the climate tech or the so-called tough tech is booming. And I think it's a real, really good place to be if you're an entrepreneur or an engineer coming out of college. I wanted to ask you, like, between 2004, 2005 and now, when did you really see an inflection point? What I mean by that is, when did you see the course change from ranting, raising a flag to this whole, you know, swarm of people getting into climate tech?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I feel like for most of the 2000s, probably like up through like 2010, solutions to climate change were so sort of distant and outrageously expensive that most of the discourse around climate change was just, as you say, like activists ranting. You know, it's just all very political and abstract. But a couple things happened. I mean, you know, I think people who are familiar with this area will be familiar with the story. Germany was a pioneer in bringing down solar costs. China was a pioneer, spent a bunch of money subsidizing domestic industry. The Obama's stimulus money did a huge amount for wind and solar in the US, and all of which combined to really, really rapidly bring down the cost of renewable energy. I mean, if I had to put my finger on one causal, you know, mechanism here, it is wind and solar getting super, super cheap. And that turns out to have all kinds of knock-on effects, like all sorts of technologies that I look at these days, which you wouldn't necessarily associate with energy generation, have only been made possible by dirt cheap renewable energy. So like wind and solar getting so cheap has unlocked all sorts of other possibilities across the economy. And as the economic case changes, all of a sudden, you know, the way I put it is, it used to be a matter of activists and politicians sort of shouting and the PR department, you know, at your big corporation, buy a few offsets or you know, do a couple of symbolic green gestures to get good press. But now, the way I put it is, these concerns have migrated from the PR department to the shop floor. Like, the engineers have their hands on it now. And now, so it's like, now things are really happening. So the cheaper wind and solar get, the cheaper everything else gets, the more industries start getting disrupted, and the more they get disrupted, the more that, you know, these things all feed on themselves. So I would put it around 2010. There was no sort of sharp break, but like the dialogue today, the discourse today is so much more down close to street level, you know, so much more tangible and concrete. There's so much more actual stuff to talk about, actual things happening, rather than just, you know, these vague apocalyptic warnings. Now, you know, if you want to get involved, it used to be, if you wanted to get involved, you know, I this is probably the number one question I've gotten my entire career. How can I get involved? And for a long time, all I could really tell people is like, go out and march in the street and carry your sign and write your legislators and bang on the table and talk about climate change a lot. But now, almost any industry, literally almost any job, almost anywhere you are, almost any neighborhood, any community, there's something happening. There's something tangible to do now. So it's just a lot more rich and fun to talk about these days.
Yeah, absolutely. And truly encouraging signs, especially in the last few years. And this reminds me of a quote by Ramiz Naam, who is based out of the Bay Area, works for Singularity.
I know him as well.
Yeah, he said a very powerful line. And he goes on to say that clean energy will win on cost if you allow it to be built. So if you don't oppose it, if you don't pose any hindrance to the technology and for the rapid rise of engineers working on it, it's going to beat fossil fuels on cost. And I think that's a very powerful statement.
For sure, for sure. I mean, this is something I tell people, that I don't think the average Joe or Jane on the street appreciates this yet, that solar and wind are, in most parts of the world, in most circumstances, the cheapest energy available to human beings. Furthermore, the cheapest energy that has ever been available to human beings, and getting cheaper all the time, right? Like on a learning curve that has been steady, relatively steady and predictable for decades now. So we have every reason to believe that it's going to get even cheaper. And it's really fun to think about. I mean, this is something that I've not really done a pod on it yet, or really broached it in a piece yet, because I don't quite know how to wrap my hands around it. But throughout human history, really, the discussion about energy has always taken place in a context of scarcity. It's always about who gets the finite resources, fighting over them, how to use them most efficiently, you know, who gets them for what. And we are moving, I think, toward a world where solar power is so cheap and there are so many different ways of storing and using it that we are going to start having to think about energy abundance, what to do in a situation of energy abundance, which has literally never been something human beings have ever thought about before. It's really a mind twister. I mean, that's a ways out, but like, we can see the runway now. We can see the trajectory. You just follow the lines on the graph, and like they're just going down. I mean, maybe there's a floor, and lots of people, you know, have lots of different theories about when this learning curve might plateau, or when we might reach some sort of rock bottom. But people have been predicting that for decades, and it just keeps going down. So it's a really fascinating time. I mean, we're really going to, especially because, you know, all solar power is in the middle of the day, basically, like when the sun's out. So we're going to have so much solar panels, so much solar power gathering, that during the middle of the day when the sun's out, all those panels are going to be generating power. And we're going to have this wave of power in the middle of the day that vastly exceeds demand, you know. So it's a real problem now. We're going to have to think about, what do we do with all this energy? What do we do with all this energy we've got that we literally don't know how to use? It's literally more than we can use. We have to start looking for uses for it. So we're like, well, we could desalinate water, you know, we could generate hydrogen. Like what possibilities are opened by abundant solar energy? It's a really fascinating thing that is so counter to the typical tone of these discussions about climate and energy, which are just doom and gloom and scarcity and problems and everything else. Like, it's just a nice counterweight to all that.
Yeah. And I've heard Elon Musk talk about this. I don't know if he's throwing numbers from his ass. You know, he's known to do that. But apparently, to power the entire US, you only need 100 by 100 square kilometers of solar power. I don't know how true that is, if it's based on research, but that's a number that I heard somewhere.
There's no right answer to that question for a lot of reasons. Like, for one thing, efficiencies still getting better and better in solar panels, even after decades of R&D, and there are new solar technologies. There's bifacial solar now, which can generate power from the top and the bottom. That's not a fixed number. And also, what does powering the U.S. mean? One of the things that we're going to have to do to decarbonize is shift a lot of what was fossil fuel combustion over to electricity, which means we're probably going to need 2 to 3 times the electricity to power the U.S. than we use today. So powering the U.S. in a decarbonized world is a way bigger job than powering the U.S. today. It's like 2 to 3 times as big. That's why, to get back to what Mez was saying, you know, we've got the cheap power now, and all the bottlenecks are the socio-political challenges of building, which are a different thing than technology, right? It's, I mean, this is something I discover over and over and over again, is that a lot of problems that look technological, you realize pretty quickly, like, we're really good at technology, right? Like, when we really bear down on it and think about it and put our minds to it, we can do almost anything technologically. But like, persuading a landowner to let you run an electricity line across his land, we don't know what technology, there's no technology that does that, right? Like, that's just social, and we're still not very good at that, not nearly as good as we are at technology.
Yeah, it's something that we have to think about, is to have visionaries at the top. And this is something that we speak in tech all the time, is, you know, we have really smart engineers, but do we have that one product manager who can get that approval from that VP to get a green signal for this product? You know, that is a very important step. So sometimes it's not about technology, it's about a lot
I talk to renewable energy developers, and they have, you know, fantastic technology people, fantastic finance people, even some good sort of like political liaisons. But what about community development? What about the people who go out to the communities where you want to build the renewable energy and persuade the community to let you do it? That is underpowered, under theorized. None of them are very good at that. Like, that's the big problem these days. That's the big lacuna. And that's all people stuff, you know. It's a lot fuzzier and more difficult than the hard engineering.
Yeah, and you spoke about electrification, and there are a lot of skeptics about EVs. It's been that way for quite some time. Keeping all the other issues about, you know, charging speeds and range anxiety aside, people fail to realize that even if all the electric cars are powered from coal, natural gas, diesel-based sources, they're still way more efficient than internal combustion engines. Like it's a fact, because of the, you know, less losses, less energy.
This is one of the most important energy facts. Like, if I was listing my top five energy facts that everybody should know, this would be up there, which is moving from fossil fuel combustion to an electric motor gets you about a 50% efficiency boost right off the bat, making no other changes. So this is something Saul Griffith, I don't know if you're familiar with Saul Griffith, he's really a genius, one of the visionaries. He wrote a book called Electrify. This is something that he's out preaching. If you move all of society from fossil fuels to electricity, even if that electricity, as you say, is made with fossil fuels, just using electric motors rather than fossil fuel combustion motors, is you can get twice as much energy, twice as much work out of the same energy, right? So like, the biggest efficiency gain you can do is to switch to electricity. So yeah, switching your car to electricity, boom, is a 50% efficiency boost. Doesn't matter where the electricity comes from, right? You're instantly using less energy to move, and producing less pollution to move right off the bat. So like, EVs are such an obvious, I mean, it's so dumb. I don't know what is causing the current, I mean, I guess I know what's causing it, the current sort of like flood of weird contrarian articles. Like, everybody wants to do one, and they're straining and reaching so hard for the goofiest arguments against EVs. But EVs are just sort of so obviously, even if, this is something I say frequently, even if climate change didn't exist, even if you didn't give a damn about CO2 emissions, EVs are better on performance, on building. There's fewer moving parts. They're easier to maintain. They're cheaper over your lifetime. Like, they're just better in every way. The fact that they can eliminate carbon emissions is just like a cherry on top. They're just better. And that's true of electricity across the board. I think it's true, a heat pump's better than a natural gas furnace, you know, like in almost any application, electricity is going to be better and more efficient than fossil fuels. This is something that people's eyes are slowly opening to.
Yeah. I mean, it is so obvious, and people don't realize it. And, you know, whenever you propose an idea or when you propose a change, in society, people are quite skeptic, and they may
Yeah.
be like, you know, there may be some cash. It, you know, there is no free lunch. But in this case, it is better in every single way.
It's about as
Like,
close to a free lunch as you can get. And what people don't do is, I mean, imagine if cars were run on electricity and I came to you and proposed running them on fossil fuels instead. Think of all the catches you'd find and all the downsides you'd find.
Yes.
It's just, we don't notice what's familiar is the big thing. Like, we just take most things that exist for granted and we give new proposals much more scrutiny, right? We're much more, but we just like, but like, if I told you we're going to get around, but to do it, we're going to have to tear up the earth and heat up the atmosphere and pollute every community in the country and cause asthma, you know, an epidemic of asthma. Like, those are drawbacks, you know, but people just don't notice them because they're so ubiquitous and familiar. But yeah, this is moving from fossil fuels to electricity is a free lunch. You
Yeah.
are, instead of wasting more than a half of your raw energy as waste heat, you're using it to get work. That's just like smart. That's just, it's just a smart thing to do, whether or not you care about emissions or not.
Absolutely. And you don't need to replace your brake pads as often. I'm going to put you in a spot for a little bit. For someone who wrote about climate for so long, what took you so long to get a Chevy Bolt?
Funny. Well, we had a Prius, you know, in our defense.
Okay, not bad.
We had a Prius, so we just don't drive much. I just don't drive much at all. But you know, I was waiting for it. It took a long time
for that price inflection.
Yeah,
of
the price
plateau.
Inflection. I just want a little cheap city car, like a hatchback.
Right.
Like, that's, you know, that's why I got the Bolt. And it's like, I don't totally understand it to this day why the EV market is still so dominated, especially in the US, well, particularly,
yes,
only, I think, in the US, completely dominated by luxury EVs. I don't get it. I don't want an SUV. I don't want, you know, even the Bolt. This is another thing that's so great about EVs, like the nimbleness and acceleration in the Bolt is wild to me compared to any gas car I've ever driven in my life. And it's just like the low end version. It's like the cheapest EV you can get, and just off the line you're like, whoa, like it's crazy how much better EVs perform. So I was just waiting, you know, for a cheap EV. And the really and the cool thing is, maybe this going too far into it, but the cool thing, and this is a tip for your listeners, the Bolts are under a recall. All the batteries from 2017 to 2021, I think, are being recalled and replaced. So if you buy a used Bolt with the old battery in it, then you get on Chevrolet's list and they will do what they did to my Bolt about 2 or 3 months ago, which is replace the battery for free per the recall. And then you have a brand new battery, and the battery is just about the only thing that wears out on an electric car, really. It's like the only big piece of maintenance. So it's more or less like getting a brand new EV. So
yeah,
there's a little hot tip for people while it's still available.
But guess what? GM has gotten a little smarter.
What
they have done is they don't want to replace all the batteries. So what they have done is they have come up with a software update which will charge your car to 80%, and then they're going to test that for 6,200 miles or something. And then if that goes well, then you can charge back.
I saw that they tried to roll that out as a substitute or a sort of makeshift while you're waiting for your new battery. I didn't know they were going to try to do that instead. But anyway, I got my new battery, so
yeah, I think
I'm excited.
You can still, I mean, if listeners, anyone has a Bolt, you can still look up the VIN number, and some of them have recalls on them, some of them don't. So I guess it just depends on what year, make, model, factory, I don't know, what batch, yeah, build, whatever. So,
you know, but the other story I tell about my personal, you know, because everybody wants to know, like, well, what have you done in your personal life, which I think is generally a silly question, but fun. It's fun to talk about anyway. The Bolt, I'm glad we did, and I enjoy driving it, and even still get a little, you know, just like that little nagging sense of guilt you felt about driving anywhere for any reason, it's gone. And I'm just like, it's a joy. But about 10 years ago, we had to replace our oil furnace. I don't know if you read about when this happened, we had to replace our oil furnace in our house. And I looked and looked and looked for heat pumps, but this was 10 years ago and they weren't anywhere. Contractors were unfamiliar with them. They're super expensive. There were no subsidies. Like I could get, I think it was like $3,000 or $4,000 subsidy to switch to a natural gas furnace from oil in Seattle. And no, nothing. Switching from oil to heat pump. That's changed since then. But anyway, long story short, I ended up bringing a natural gas connection to my house and buying a natural gas furnace. And I hate it. I've hated it ever since. I feel guilty about it to this day. I often think about when is the earliest I can switch it back out for a heat pump.
Yeah, I would recommend watching a video of Robert Levlin. He hosts the Fully Charged show and Fully Charged podcast. And he has completely transformed his house into, you know, out of the grid. I don't think it's quite out of the grid, but it's like sort of self-sustaining. And and he lives in England, so pretty similar to Seattle. Yeah. And talking about heat pumps, I feel like one of the things that GM got wrong on the Chevy Bolt is not having heat pumps. So the moment you turn on the heater, then the range drops quite drastically.
Yeah, and the cold, they're not lying about the cold affecting the range either. That's no deal. I mean, one of the interesting stories I read the other day is that used EVs are actually having trouble selling, and I think that's because we're early enough in the whole cycle that each new generation of EVs is so much better than the previous one that it's like it feels like a sacrifice to buy an old one, whereas like an iPhone 13 versus 14, you don't care that much, but right now we're in such a fantastically accelerated development of EVs that it's like, that's why I held off for so long. I think that's why a lot of people are holding off because like every new year brings a bunch of new models, a bunch of new choices, a bunch of new technologies. So you just got to like jump at some point.
Yeah. But I think we are almost in that area because, you know, we have cars that have gone on to do 100,000 miles and the battery still has 98-97% capacity. So it's pretty okay to buy a used car, but make sure that, you know, there is going to be a switch to the NACS adapter. So just have to be mindful about that. But
anyway, you got to be careful about the Leaf, the old Leafs, Chademo, right? They don't use that. They don't use them.
Yeah. Anyway, we went on a bit of a digression, but like coming back to climate change, technology, investing, I was looking at this graph about climate change venture funding between 2016 and 2022. You know, the graph went up from 2016 around the time you mentioned that there was a increase in influx. And then it goes up and then it comes down in 2019. It comes down around 20%. And then it goes up back again to 2018 levels in 2020. And then it has been on a rise ever since. And, you know, maybe I'm reading between the lines, but it's sort of coinciding with the Trump administration. How much of venture capital attitude is dependent on who is at the White House?
Well, this is a complicated nest of subjects. So
yeah, I know there is no silver bullet answer, but yeah, I just want to get your thought about it.
Backing up a little bit, you know, people might remember the sort of first round of kind of hype and then bust in clean tech in like the 2010 to 2015 range. And I think a lot of that was venture capital going to clean tech with a venture capital mindset, which is big, fast, you know, big, fast gambles. And I think what everyone discovered was energy is not like the internet, right? Energy is not like infotech. It's big. It's slow often to build. You know, these time horizons are much larger, the amounts are much larger. And so you need something more like infrastructure funding. But then the infrastructure investors lack the VC appetite for risk that
this
might
is,
that
this is so
right?
true.
So, because, so you have a neither one of them is quite right.
Yeah, and yeah. This is so true because I spoke to Aruna Ramakrishnan, and she works on getting some catalysts to lower the emissions and so on. And she said the same thing, is that VCs have always invested in high growth tech industries, and nobody wants to invest in tough tech because, you know, sometimes they lack the technical know-how, they don't know the industry as well. So bang on, I think you're right.
Yeah, and another thing that we've found out about energy investing versus sort of info tech investing is that it is more political and does depend more on policy. Like when you're building these things all brush up against or are infrastructure. So there's a lot of public private interaction. There's a lot, you know, policy matters a lot, which is why I think when someone like Trump comes in, who's openly hostile to the whole thing, people rightly think, well, policy is not going to be supportive of these things. I mean, part of what is such a big deal about the Inflation Reduction Act is that it takes all these tax credits that we've been using to encourage clean tech, which have been coming and going and coming and going and rising, you know, like with every administration, locks them in, basically locks them in quasi-permanently, which just like, this is what investors need, is a line of sight. When you're investing in stuff like this, power plants and you know, power lines, big things like this, you need a line of sight out a decade or whatever. And this is what IRA has done, which is why it has prompted such a massive flood of domestic investment.
Yeah. I mean, we all know the IRA, the Inflation Reduction Act, is sort of piggybacking on the BBA, Build Back Better Act. And unfortunately, the Build Back Better did not go through. What percentage of the merits of the Build Back Better is in IRA? And,
oh, this is a fascinating question, politically fascinating, because Build Back Better, the original vision from House Democrats when they first got in 2020, was immense. It had health care, elder care, you know, voting reform, on and on. It had the whole Democratic agenda squeezed into the bill. It was huge. And over time, over the next year or two, things just kept getting picked off and picked out and eliminated and swatted down and trimmed and hacked away over and over, on. And just about in the end, the only thing that survived, not totally intact, but mostly intact from the original Build Back Better, was the energy stuff, was the climate stuff, which I think is a very interesting fact about current politics. I think it really shows you that Democrats have come around on this, that they're united on this, and there's less concentrated Republican opposition to it than there is on a lot of other things. Like, it's just, to me, it's just politically interesting that when you have a 50-50 Senate and you need absolute unity among Democrats to get anything done, just about the only thing that could get Democratic unity was clean energy, which just, to me, shows that it's like politically so powerful.
Yeah, that is so fascinating. I mean, I think we do see examples on the Republican side as well, about, you know, people interested in climate change, especially one of the senators from Mississippi, I forget the name, I think Walker. He really wants to build railways quite a bit. You won't really associate a senator from Mississippi to be, I think his name is Senator Wicker. Yeah, to really push for railways in Mississippi. But yeah, there is. It's a good thing that, you know, both parties are reaching to some form of consensus, at least on this issue, and it's a.
I don't know about that. I wouldn't. I'm not nearly that sanguine about Republicans. I'm not nearly that optimistic about Republicans. I mean, there are you can find examples where a Republican, where clean energy is so obviously and manifestly advantageous for their constituents that they'll do this or that, like this factory or this railway line or this particular policy. But on the larger question, do we need to transition as quickly as possible away from fossil fuels to clean energy? They're just all, I mean, if anything, like old school denialism is coming back. Like, so who knows, you know, the sort of immediate financial and pecuniary interests of Republicans are once again in conflict with their ideology, and we'll see how that shakes out. But I would just say, like, this is what I say all the time when people want to know, like, what the party's agendas are on this. It gets muddled when you only follow federal policy because there's so many currents and countercurrents. One way to clarify things is look at states, right? So there are states where Republicans have taken complete control, called a trifecta, the governor, the House, the Senate, and a state level. And there are states where Democrats have taken complete control and gotten a trifecta. And if you want to know what their agendas are, just look at what they do when they take complete control and the other party can no longer stop them, right? So Republican states, you know, they go banning trans kids in sports and banning books. And in the states where Democrats have gotten a trifecta, you are getting a flood of incredible energy policy in Colorado, Massachusetts, Washington. I mean, just really incredible stuff. All the stuff from the IRA, from the Inflation Reduction Act, from Build Back Better, really, all the energy stuff, almost all of it is drawn from state policy. It's states that are doing the innovation here and are way out ahead. And so, you know, just like a couple of weeks ago, the Massachusetts regulators just released an incredible order basically telling gas utilities in the state, you're on your way out. Like, get used to it, you know, make peace with your God, do what you need to do, like you're on your way out. So the gap between the parties on this is huge and yawning. I don't know how long that will last, but that is certainly how it is now.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't think I could find a lot more examples than this particular.
You really got to reach. I mean, well, you see like all these investments that are flooding in because of the IRA into like battery factories in the South and EV factories. The Republican politicians from those areas, they'll go to the ribbon cutting, right? They'll go and say, hey, look what I did. Look what I brought you, you know, even though they voted against it. Like, they'll take it. They'll take credit for the results, but they are not much help in forming them.
Mm. Yeah, interesting. I was looking at states which have the highest percentage of electricity production from renewable sources. And I saw some interesting observations.
Not what you think.
Yeah. I mean, I saw Iowa.
Iowa, in the list. Texas.
I saw Texas in the list. Yeah, I saw Vermont in the list. I saw California in the list, but not as much as Iowa and Texas. Is the land, is the location playing a role here? What do you think?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, Iowa for sure. Like, Iowa is just very, very windy. And sort of like Iowa kind of got going on wind, got the kind of self-reinforcing cycle going before, like a long time ago, before the current sort of political, you know, before it all got politicized. So like the wind industry was off and running in Iowa has been a long time. And at this point is big enough and has enough money and power and influence to have Republican, you know, the Republican senators defending it in Iowa. And that's partly just because it's incredibly windy. Texas is an interesting example because there's a place where the legislators are, if you listen to what they say, ideologically opposed to clean energy. They love fossil fuels. That's all they talk about. But the energy market there is unusually kind of a free-for-all. It's kind of unusually open. It's kind of unusually market-y and less regulated than some other energy markets. And consequently, the cheapest stuff wins. And so wind has been winning. And also they're really good at building transmission. They're really good at reducing the bureaucratic barriers to transmission. And the more transmission you build, that just unlocks more renewable energy. So it's interesting that Texas's devotion to the to markets is undermining its ideological position on energy, right? Because clean energy is flooding into Texas and just dominating there because ultimately it's super cheap, and that speaks louder than any amount of Fox News segments.
Yeah, I was really surprised to see Texas on the list, because Houston is like the oil capital and whatnot, right? But yeah, it's good. I mean, I'm gonna take it.
Yeah, it's yeah. Eventually those industries will, just through the normal workings of politics, get big enough that they'll be able to defend their interests in the state house. Right now, they're still passing ludicrously, like they're still servants of natural gas, basically, in the Texas state house. But it's not enough, because one thing we're finding out is natural gas isn't particularly reliable, right? That was the whole value proposition. And it turns out it's not. Like, it keeps going offline, it keeps tripping offline, and they keep having blackouts, and they keep almost freezing to death in Texas because of natural gas, and coal piles are freezing in place. So it's all, the whole question of reliability is also playing out in Texas in interesting ways.
Yeah. Yeah, we spoke about state, we spoke about the center, Washington, D.C., the Hill. Now let's talk about companies. We see a lot of companies taking initiative. We see Google, committing to net zero, the whole 24/7 project. We saw the Apple ad that went viral this year during the launch iPhone. I don't know if they're doing it just for the badge, or they're doing it like we spoke about before, is renewable energy is going to beat, non-renewable is going to beat renewable at any cost. Sorry, the other way around. non-renewable is going to beat renewable for cost. So do they see any financial incentive, or is it just for the badge?
I think you could have said it was just for the badge 10 years ago. Maybe even 5 years ago,
right?
But not anymore. The people at Google, like I said, it's gone from the PR department to the shop floor. Like, now the people in Google have their teeth in this thing, and engineers love solving problems. Like, they love, like, it's fun just to listen to them talk. Like, they're gripped by this now, and they know, due to policy, due to costs, due to all sorts of forces, that they need to shift to clean energy. And so they are off and running. Like, Google is really committed. The people at Microsoft are really committed. They're doing more than people even know they're doing. Like, they're, and like, I'm not sure people are aware that, like, in terms of contracts for renewable energy, in terms of PPAs and stuff like that.
Yeah, they hired a really talented Chief Sustainability Officer recently, right? Microsoft.
Yes, and Amazon is the biggest corporate purchaser of PPAs, and corporate PPAs are like 2/3 of renewable growth. Like, so it's they've become a real positive force in spreading clean energy. What's interesting is there's one set of concerns, which is, where do we get clean electricity to power our stuff? Because we're mostly computing business, and so most of our pollution or our environmental worries are about the generation of that energy. So like Google's like that, it's basically like, how do we run our data centers, how do we get the electricity to do our computing? But what's interesting is you go to Apple, and people sort of think of Apple as a tech company, but they're a stuff company. They make stuff. They make physical stuff, right? Hardware. And that's a whole different, much more complicated, much more just like fascinating set of issues, which is, when you start talking about Scope 3 emissions, right? So Scope 1, if just for your audience doesn't know it, Scope 1 is sort of the power you use on site, right? Which is obviously your responsibility. Scope two is how it is the electricity that you use, how's that generated, right? That's scope two. But then scope three is what goes into the materials and supply chain of the stuff you use and the stuff you make, and how do people use what you make, right? So it's like a much broader view. And so when you come to something like Apple, scope three is enormous. Where do the materials to come from to make all, not just the phones and computers, but the elements of the phones and computers, right? The chunks, the pieces of the phones and computers. How are they made? Where does that power come from? Where do those materials come from? What do people do with these computers when they're sold out? How do they dispose of the computers when they're done with the computers? All of that comes within Apple's scope three. So like, that's a whole, just a mind-boggling kind of, just to get your head around all the pieces involved in that. It's so much bigger than what somebody like Google is dealing with. So that's like this, to me, that's kind of like the frontier, is that scope three and what are called embedded emissions, right? So like if I buy a piece of equipment, what emissions were involved in making it, that kind of thing. And so now Apple, which to me is real positive, real first mover in this area, is using its enormous size and its enormous power and influence to basically get its supply chain, right? Like now, if you want to sell stuff to Apple, you have to report the scope 1, 2, and 3 emissions of your products that you're selling to Apple. So just by using its buying power and its immense market power, it is pulling levers that are causing changes throughout the economy, extending way out to other countries and way down to mines, you know, like all the way down. It's really fascinating. The materials side of it is very fascinating to me.
Yeah, that's a fantastic point, because if someone with deep pockets doesn't do it or doesn't move the needle, who else will? And it's lovely to see Apple sort of propagate its mission through its supplier, you know, A supplier, B supplier, and so on.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's fantastic. And I think one of the other notable mentions is the Clean Energy Buyers Alliance. I think, you know, it's like a consortium of GM, Johnson mm-hmm. & Johnson, Microsoft, Walmart, even Google, I guess, and who are moving the needle quite a bit.
Yeah, I love all the efforts at using procurement to create positive change, right? Like I was, for instance, just the other day, I did a pod on cement. You know, cement is 8% of global emissions, and now people are developing these low carbon and no carbon versions of cement, which of course at the beginning costs more. And so what's going to scale those up? It is big buyers of concrete saying we will pay extra for better concrete, right? And that's governments, that's big companies like Apple and Google, et cetera, et cetera. So using your buying power is a huge, huge lever here.
Yeah, I think Google also worked with a company called Fervo Energy, something.
Oh, yes. One of my favorites. One of my beloved favorites. One of my favorite, like if I list my two or three technologies I'm most excited about, Fervo and enhanced geothermal is always on the list. So if your listeners don't know, if I could just give a little boost for Fervo, a little cheerleading for Fervo, you know, so traditional geothermal energy, you can only get it where you find natural faults, right, that are creating this friction and this heat underground, and you can exploit that. But those are limited geographic areas, right? There's some out west in the US, there's a lot in Japan, but not on the kind of scale you'd need. So what enhanced geothermal does is, this guy, Tim, the CEO, came from oil and gas, came from fracking. And what they're doing is using fracking technology, number one, to create those fractures in the ground anywhere so that you create the heat, and then drilling down and drilling horizontally, right? Which is a huge breakthrough in natural gas fracking. You can drill horizontally. So they're creating a series of fractures and then drilling horizontally through them, which just means you can get geothermal electricity almost anywhere. You can create your own geothermal features and get energy out of them almost anywhere. And geothermal is carbon-free. It's always on, right? It's not variable like wind and solar. It's always on, so it's great backup. It's great reliability. And they're even experimenting with ways of capping the output well while continuing to pump down the input well, which just increases the pressure underground, which serves as a kind of giant battery. It serves as a kind of giant energy storage. So you could look at geothermal as being like the Swiss Army knife of energy generation. It's always on. It's reliable. It's baseload if you want it. It's flexible if you want it. It's storage if you want it. It's available anywhere, right? You don't need to be sitting on a particular geography. So Fervo is the first company that has opened a commercial plant using these technologies just a few weeks ago. It started actually producing power. To me, that's huge, hugely. I still don't think people are as excited about it as they should be. And there's not getting as much investment as it should be. If I could, you know, if I yell at investors, that's always the first thing I say is like, enhanced geothermal is the skeleton key here. Like dump some money on it. Let's scale this up.
Yeah. Yeah. Shout out to Fervo and all the work they're doing. I want to go on a little bit of a digression. What do you think about carbon sequestration, carbon capture? Is it practical? Because, you know, I got to know of a company, Climeworks, I think it's based out of Iceland, that is doing it, moving the needle quite a bit. But I was reading Peter Kalmus, the data scientist from the Jet Propulsion Lab from NASA. He said that to scale this up, we will need 10 million such plants, and that carbon capture is not quite a practical way of looking at things. It's like fixing a broken window. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, my thoughts on this are complicated. There's a lot of different thoughts. I got to go to Iceland this year, and I got to see the Climeworks, the famous Climeworks, big fans. You know, they got the big fans. I got to wander around inside the building. Really fascinating. But it really did bring home, I'm like, what an enormous amount of hardware to capture what is, in absolute terms, a relatively small amount of CO2. So it does really bring home the scale. And another company I visited in Iceland on the sequestration side, they're actually, Climeworks is capturing their CO2, and then they're piping it over to CarbonFix, this company, which takes the geothermal water. You know, in geothermal, you bring the water up, you get the heat out of it, you pump it back down. It's this loop of water. So what they do is, before the geothermal water at the geothermal plant gets pumped back down, they carbonate it with this carbon from Climeworks, like literally like you would with a soda stream. They just carbonate it, and then they pump it back underground. And the CO2 in the water reacts with the minerals in the rock and calcinates, becomes rock, and stays there forever. So it's like a fantastic, fantastically clever and relatively cheap version of sequestration. But to answer your question more broadly, I would say it's incredibly expensive, energy intensive, materials intensive, difficult. And unlike almost everything else in clean tech, there's no other benefit you get from it, right? Like solar power, you're reducing CO2 emissions, but you're also getting electricity. Like for almost any other product, there's a market proposition for it outside of its environmental benefits. But when it comes with capture and sequestration, you're not getting anything else out of that. All you're doing is reducing emissions, which means ultimately it's going to be publicly funded, I think. I mean, it's ultimately going to be public money. And it also means, to my mind, that in the fullness of time, it's not going to be like people talk about, you know, the best way to make hydrogen is just do it with fossil fuels and then capture the emissions and bury them. It's not going to be the solution to anything where there's an alternative solution. And there's always going to be an alternative solution. So I think what we're going to be left with in the end is just not capturing CO2 from fossil fuel based processes. We're going to electrify everything, basically. And in that we don't electrify, we're going to come up with clean fuels like hydrogen or ammonia or whatever. And I don't think in the end we're going to need much industrial capture. That said, even if the entire globe stopped emitting carbon tomorrow, there's already more carbon dioxide in the atmosphere than is safe for humans in the long term. So even, you know, in best case scenario, you're going to need to draw some of it down and bury it. The interesting political question, which is still very much up in the air, is, I mean, what people like Peter worry about is what's called the moral hazard, right? Like, if oil and gas catch wind of the idea that, like, oh, we can keep doing what we're doing, we'll just bury the emissions, we don't need to stop what we're doing, right? That's a bad signal to send, because you're never going to be able to bury enough to compensate for the amount of fossil fuels that are burned these days. Never, ever, ever. Like, you're going to have to reduce fossil fuels to a tiny nub, and then maybe you can bury that much emissions. But, like, compensating for today's fossil fuels is just absolutely ludicrous. But it is a moral hazard. It does. Are they worried that it reduces pressure to reduce emissions, right? Which is legit. It's a legit worry, and it's something to keep your eye on. But even given that, we're going to have to figure out the technology. We're going to have to figure out cheaper ways of doing it, because we're going to have to draw some carbon down out of the atmosphere to be safe in the long term, regardless. So it's complicated and fraught. Yeah.
And when I think about it, I feel like, what a stupid idea, right? You have carbon, you have like two carbon reservoirs, one beneath the Earth's surface and one the atmosphere. You're taking carbon from underneath the Earth's surface, blowing it out in the atmosphere, and then capturing that and burying it into the ground. So
not just that, taking it out of the Earth's crust and radically expanding the volume it occupies, and then trying to recapture it, right?
Yeah, doesn't make sense in my head.
No, it's an absurd solution to any specific energy problem. I will bet almost any amount of money, whether it's heavy industry, shipping, you know, pick your application, we're going to figure out something better than capturing emissions out of the flue stream and burying them. We're going to figure out something better than that for every application
that can scale as well. So yeah,
yes,
perfectly put. So we spoke about states, we spoke about electrifying America, and one of the things that comes up in these discussions is the grid, and we have not solved the grid.
My favorite.
And I think solving the grid would, you know, eliminate a lot of problems. We know how to solve the grid, but like you mentioned earlier in the episode, is it politics and paperwork and red tape that is preventing it? What are your thoughts? Where are we in that journey of unifying
American
grid?
The first thing I just stress is, you know, still I think when I bring up the grid to people, to normies, you know, people who aren't obsessives about this stuff, who have normal lives, they think of it as like some kind of obscure technical thing I'm talking about, like something only nerds think about, blah, blah, blah. I think we need to get over that.
Let's maybe break it down for like a 30-second 101 on what we are discussing about the grid.
Yeah. So a couple of things. I mean, there's a couple of different angles you can take on it. One is simply the best way to decarbonize is to electrify. And if we're going to electrify everything, we're going to need 2 to 3 times more electricity. And if we have 2 to 3 more times electricity demand, we're going to need 2 to 3 times more capacity in our grid. So just at a baseline level, we need to build a bunch more grid. Like, that's the simplest thing to think about in terms of grid. And right now, it's just very, very difficult to build anything anywhere, especially in the US. So that's one thing. The other set of grid questions to me is even more interesting, which is the traditional grid, which was like from the time there were grids up until like 5 minutes ago, is big power plant, big distant power plants produce power. They send it over these big transmission pipelines, and then it gets dumped into your local distribution grid and you use it, right? It's a one-way flow. They produce it, transmission, distribution, you use it. Very simple and pretty simple to maintain. You just sort of measure how much demand is there in this distribution grid. That's what I'm going to turn my factory. I'm going to turn my, you know, turn my producer up a little bit and produce a little more. Pretty easy peasy. What's happening now is down at the distribution grid, right? It used to be just dumb, passive consumers, right? But now all sorts of interesting stuff is happening down there. It's called the grid edge, as they call it, down at the distribution grid, which is people are generating their own power through, you know, solar panels and things like that. They're storing power through home batteries and through EVs, you know, and they're exchanging power. So the whole system is becoming much, much more dynamic down at the distribution side. And what I think is interesting is, because right now all the sort of like regulated market stuff is up at the transmission level. All the energy markets work at the transmission level with these huge regional markets. But distribution utilities are basically just wires maintainers, right? Not that big, not that smart, not that complicated what they're doing. They bill customers and they make sure, you know, if a squirrel eats through a line, they go fix it. What we need is administrative entities at the distribution level that are way smarter and more sophisticated, that can start to coordinate and manage all that activity at the distribution side in a smart way, so that you're maximizing your local resilience and your local self-reliance, right? You're getting as much energy as you can out of the local level, and only then do you get the remainder from the transmission system, from the big power plants, right? That's an inversion of priority. You're starting at the ground up rather than starting top down. And that shift from a top down grid to a bottom up grid is intellectually fascinating, just as a matter of abstraction, just like information theory, and you know, there's all sorts of interesting questions involved in it. But B is also a super complicated political question, right? Because you need to, who's going to create these distribution level entities? Who's going to legally regulate them? How are they going to relate to the transmission level entities? Like, it's just disrupting a business model that's been basically the same for about a century. Mm-hmm. And not only the same, but a pretty sleepy business sector, right? I mean, the cool thing about being a utility is your returns on investment are guaranteed by law. So all you have to do is spend money and you make money. There's not a lot of business dynamism, let's just say, in that, or hasn't been traditionally in that sector. It's been very sleepy. You just, you know, there are like generations, like, you know, dad worked at the utility and granddad worked at the, it was an old boys network, and a pretty sleepy old boys network up until, like I said, like 5 minutes ago. And now all of a sudden we're going to these entities, which have been sort of like just printing money for decades, and being like, time to be super dynamic, super innovative, time to lead the energy transition, time to try this and experiment with this and change your rate base, change your rate structure, and, you know, build all these new technologies. It must be, from utilities perspective, disorienting. It's a real fast change coming to that sector, but they're the ones that have to administer these grid changes. So that's sort of the two big grid questions are, one, we just need more of it, full stop. More transmission, more distribution, and it's difficult to do that, and we need to overcome the barriers to do that. And two is the sort of administrative governance structure of shifting from top down to bottom up. Both of those have to be done at the same time, right? Expanding massively while shifting your governance structure, while also, let's keep in mind, being required by law to be absolutely reliable, to provide absolutely steady, always on, affordable energy to everyone. I mean, it's it's wild what needs to happen, but it's you know, like, that's the big, if electricity is the main thing, and it is, then the grid is the main thing. It's going to be much more central to our energy life than it was in the past. So everybody needs to sort of get up to speed on the grid, I think.
Yeah, I mean, US is built up of so many utility companies. It's sort of like a cartel. Should it happen at a more unified level, in the sense that, you know, is nationalization of power grid an option? I know people are going to hate me for this, but
I mean, if you mean a live political option, probably not. I do think there are, it is awkward, the governance structure we have now. It's sort of awkward in that you need, on the one hand, more governance lower down, right, at the distribution side. And at the other side, like, these regional entities are not coordinating very well or planning very well, and they're not building the transmission they need, especially from one region to another. Right, it's almost impossible to build lines that go, that cross these regional boundaries. So you're right, like, on the transmission, on the distribution side, you need local governance. On the transmission side, you need more national governance. I think I would love to see a national grid plan. And you see right now FERC and legislators trying to fumble their way towards something like that within the general legal, you know, confines we find ourselves, trying to get to something closer to national planning, which, yeah, like, if anything, if you understand how grids work, like, the broader of a geographical area it covers, the more reliable it is, the cheaper it is, et cetera. Like, grids get better as they get bigger. So it is insane that the US is composed of these little regional kingdom grid kingdoms, which don't hardly interact with one another. It's insane. Like, you need a national transmission system. I don't think we're ever going to get anything as dramatic as, like, a law that says we're nationalizing this sucker. Like, we're taking it by the reins. Yeah. I can't, it's hard for me to envision that happening, but we're incrementally backing our way towards something like national planning right now.
Yeah, that would be nice if some apocalypse happens in Texas, like it happened, I think, a couple of years ago. It's not going to be cut off, and it can use something generated in the Midwest to power itself.
I mean, it's crazy. Like, Texas almost froze to death a couple of years ago because their grid is not connected to surrounding grids. Like, they are so committed to that. And the reason they're doing that, just in case anybody doesn't know, is as long as you don't cross state lines, you don't come under federal jurisdiction. So Texas wants to have its own grid that's entirely state run with no feds telling them what to do. And they're so committed to that that they're willing to, like, spend enormous amounts of redundant money, right, building more stuff than they need when they could just import. And they're willing to, like, almost freeze to death every couple of years. Like, it's insane, the suffering they're going through, rather than just, like, build a transmission line north, build one west, like, bring in power from surrounding areas, and, like, your life would be so much easier. But they're so, it's a real ideological, you know, it really shows the power of ideology, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. David, before we end this podcast, I want to ask you something that I have thought about quite a bit. Is the fossil fuel industry, you know, really shot into prominence, you know, 1920s, 30s, and then the automobiles took over. And then there was this whole Rockefeller Standard Oil Company, antitrust and all of that. And then there was severe lobbying in Washington to get into fracking and all of that. You know, if renewable energy companies get to that point where they become seriously monopolized or seriously powerful, do you see a point where what fossil fuel industry did at Washington, something similar renewable energy industry is going to do at Washington? Do you fear that something similar is going to happen? Or is it going to be like, hey, fossil fuel industry, you guys are the bad people. We renewable industry are the good people, and we're going to be good all the way.
Well, I mean,
too soon to predict, I know, but I'm just putting it out there.
They're not going to have their halo forever. No, like big industries become big industries. None of them act out of virtue. But I don't think it's just going to be a one-to-one replacement, because there are like the fossil fuel industry is so deeply shaped by geographical scarcity, right? Like the accident of where it is lends the people who happen to be sitting on top of it purely contingent, right? Purely by chance.
Don't you think
immense power?
Don't you think it's similar to similar with solar as well? Like countries closer to the equator.
Some will have more and less solar, but solar is available almost anywhere. Wind is available almost anywhere. Geothermal, like we were just discussing now, is available almost anywhere. So, I mean, right now, people don't understand. There's a relatively small handful of fossil fuel producing countries. Most countries are importers, are consumers. So most countries would benefit enormously from having their own energy. It's only the small handful of producers that are really going to get screwed by this. So I just think renewable energy structurally, physically lends itself to much broader distribution and much more to community ownership. Like I really like community solar, I think, is a big deal. Community ownership of energy resources and thinking of energy as a part of municipal policy, something that the city controls, just like it controls its own transportation policy and its own waste removal policy. It's going to have its own energy, and there's going to be a lot more local control. So I don't think it lends itself to big, mean monopolies in the same way that fossil fuels does. I mean, who knows what could happen? Like the perfidy of capitalism, you know, can always surprise you. But I generally think, like, all things being equal, this is gonna be a nice trade for everybody.
Yeah. I think this is as close to a free lunch as you can get, like we mentioned earlier in the episode.
We can have nice things. I like to say it again and again.
Right. And like you said, you know, no company has a halo around them. So it can get bad, but I don't think it'll get as bad as it got with the fossil fuel industry.
Like ultimately you buy the solar panel and then it's yours and the energy is yours and you can do with it whatever you want to do with it, right? It's just very different. You buy a car, you buy a gas car, you're also implicitly connecting yourself to a fossil fuel company because you have to go back and fuel it again and again and again and again and again. But if you buy, you know, solar panel, then it's yours to do with as you wish. And you can charge your own EV. Like you can just, it much more lends itself to local independence and local resilience, I think.
Perfectly summed up. Well, David, it was a pleasure talking to you. And super grateful that you gave so much time to discuss the energy industry, climate change at length. I think this conversation could have gone on forever because we barely scratched the surface.
Yes.
I mean, I say this with almost everybody, but it's so true. I mean, we could have discussed about countries. I mean, there is just so much. You have an entire podcast on this, which is Volts. I think I really encourage everybody to check it out. Also, check out David's Substack at www.volts.wtf. I recommend checking out each and every episode because I think, David, what you do is put in a tremendous amount of effort and tremendous amount of research behind all your episodes, and the variety of guests that you get on your podcast is truly remarkable. Like I mentioned earlier in the podcast, more than ranting, I think the podcast focuses on solutions and bringing interesting people. And I think this is a good time to host a podcast as well because there is so much going on. So
if you're depressed about climate change, come listen. It will cheer you up.
Absolutely. David also has a Patreon, so definitely go and donate. Loved it, David. I think it was a fantastic episode, and I'm sure the audience is going to get a lot out of it.
Thank you. Thanks. Appreciate it.